It gives me very great pleasure to introduce Shuba, who is someone that I wanted to get to come and talk to a Paradisic gathering for quite a long time. Shuba is the perfect person to give a keynote address at our conference. Shuba Chowdhury is the let me see if I can get this right.
Just the director.
The director of the hang on, I've got it all written down here.
Thank you.
Is the director of the
Archives Engine.
Of the archives in the American Institute of Indian Studies.
Archives and Research Centre for
Delhi,
Ethnomusicology.
Yes. In the Research Centre for Ethnomusicology. And she's going to be talking to us today about some of her wonderful work that she's been doing. Like me, she's an archivist and a field worker. And we've also known each other for many years through the International Council for Traditional Music. Shuba's published some really influential and important work, including the Archives for the Future. Global Perspectives on Audiovisual Archives in the 21st Century, which was a collection that was edited by her and Tony Seeger back in 2004 or
something like
that, and which had a lot of influence on some of the decisions that we made in Paradisic when we were establishing our platform. So she's been an influence from afar for quite some time, and now I'm absolutely thrilled that she's here to talk to us about her work. So thank you very much, Shuba.
Thank you, Linda. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm really thankful to Linda and Nick and Paradisic for having me here. I've been admiring the work from afar, though not always being able to keep up with things. It's also really nice to be in Melbourne after 25 years. I first visited Australia, was only to Melbourne in 1987, and I haven't been back since, so it feels very special. When Linda asked me to speak, to do the keynote here, I thought I'd talk about community archives, because that's the direction my work has been taking of late. But then I thought of kind of unpacking it a little and looking at what the relationship archives have with the community and how, as archives have changed, I think the community that we talk about also has been changing. And I thought I would use the opportunity to kind of reflect on our own work at the ARCE, the Archives and Research Center for Ethnomusicology, and see how we have gone along the path, changing our communities. And since it's a constant preoccupation of mine, I'm also trying to look at the IPR, kind of do an IPR trace through the whole things to see how our attitudes have changed towards intellectual property rights and how the situation has changed for us. So this was the basic idea, that I would try and look at how the two interconnect. And I think that a lot of what I want to look at is to do with ownership and identity, of how, who owns what, and how do we look at the community, who do we consider the community, and so on. So who is the community can be a lot of things, a lot of people, but basically people who contribute, the people who use, the people whose music it is, since I'm talking about an ethnomusicology archive. And to look at what the basic responsibilities are of an archive towards its community, we always talk about preservation, about providing access, dissemination, and so on. But I also feel very importantly, we also represent the people whose culture we have in our archives. So to start my little case study on ARCE, so we were established in 1982 as part of the American Institute of Indian Studies. I also think it's interesting to see how archives get created, how repositories, and that's something we share with Paradisic, get formed. So this is interesting because it's a group of international scholars, American in this case, who were behind wanting to start an archive in India. It's because all the early recordings of Indian music were made by foreign scholars. This is partly the old colonial past of India, with people who were who came in, but also others like Arnold Bakke, who was Dutch ethnomusicologist who worked in India in the 1930s, and so on. So all the major collections were in archives in other parts of the world. So the basic idea was to create a repository in India where these collections could be brought to, and also to make sure that this did not continue. So ARC was formed so that people who, foreign scholars largely, who were in India recording and doing their research would have a place to deposit their recordings. And there was, at that time, no such institution in India. There were archives and there were music collections, but they were all archiving material that they themselves created. This, there was no place that would take in a collection and agree to preserve it and put in all that infrastructure, as we know, which is huge, to preserve all the air conditioning that we needed and all the whole the thing that goes with it. So the focus was on foreign collections, so material that would otherwise not be accessible in India. So if it was in India, we were not interested in taking in it in, and it was a voluntary deposit format. So, and we slowly sort of added collections in India which are in need of physical preservation. So our first few years, and when I was kind of going through our list of collections to try and do a little summary for this, I found that I think up to the first 50 collections, I don't think we had any Indian collections at all. But then as we opened that second category, the collections have started increasing. And there was also supposed to be a research center, and for that, our kind of flag was to wave ethnomusicology, to do whatever we could to support the study of ethnomusicology in India. So as you can see, it was a very post-colonial kind of, so I just have these bubbles around of, you know, what was the kind of things in those days, though we never used the word repatriation. It was definitely there in the background, in the minds of Nazir Jai Razboy and others who were behind creating this. So it is an interesting structure that we are within the American Institute of Indian Studies, and that was partly always has a story in funding, that our first grant came from the Smithsonian, which needed an American institute to take in the money in India. So that was part of it. But it meant we had an American-based advisory, which was headed first by Nazir Jai Razboy, Daniel Newman, Anthony Seeger, and so on, so which is why that connection. So our community at that time were largely the depositors and the users. So we were largely foreign scholars, researchers, and other kinds of institutions. So that's the kind of community we started out with in 1982. As I said, and I thought this might be a good time to talk of repatriation, also gives us some links with Paradisic here. These were some of the collections, major collections, where either we sought funding or the collectors or the scholars in that case sought funding to bring their collections to India. From that, the Arnold Bakke and the Fox Strangways are very old ones. The British Library helped us with that one. We had some other grants. Very large collection of Gunther Sontheimer was the South Asia Institute and Heidelberg that worked together to bring this collection to us and so on. So these are some of the larger collections that we were able to get, which had been created prior to ARC being there. So just to give you a little summary of the kind of collections that we got, we hit 226 as of, I think, last week. And I thought I didn't want to go on about giving you various charts and figures, but the Indian institutions, Indian scholars, Indian collectors and musicians has been a slowly rising figure, and I think in terms of hours, it's equal if now not more, because we received some very large collections. What we take in, I haven't put down that anywhere, we take in anything that's of relevance to the study of ethnomusicology in India. So it can be a big range. We have the Indian classical traditions, the Hindustani music and Carnatic music that you hear about, and a range of regional traditions from all over India. And a very recent collection that I was telling Kevin about yesterday was a large collection of Indian jazz. So anybody who wants to study popular music in India can now come to ARCE. There was a famous jazz festival that was called Jazz Yatra, held in India from 78 to 2003. And we've now got all the collections that went behind that. So it's a range of things.
So looking at the IPR situation there, what in 1982 when we started, in the Indian Copyright Act really had no space for our kind of material. Everything that was traditional was part of what was then called expressions of folklore, now called traditional cultural expression. So whether it was Ravi Shankar or whether it was Amanganiya from Rajasthan, it was all expressions of folklore and then hence not covered at all by the Copyright Act. So all that we had was a deposit agreement, which was made very much along the lines of other international archives at the time. I think we looked at Indiana and UCLA and so on, and Berlin and I don't know where else, and came up with this form, which was a pretty standard one at that time. And the other legal form we had was a request form that was also, that made sure that people could not misuse it anyway. It was only used for research and educational purposes, and we would sue you if we got sued and so on. So this was pretty standard. The depositor chose the degrees of access. We had three options. No access for a very limited period. We tried to limit that to 5 years and asked people to choose the next one so that we weren't trapped like a lot of archives have been with recordings they don't know what to do with. The second very common one was you could listen or look at, view it at ARC only. And the third is that you could have copies for research or educational purposes. Now, this was pretty standard. We've got all our collections with these agreements. And that seemed very often like a very good place to be in, that we didn't have any recordings that weren't covered by any agreement, which a lot of archives, again, end up with. But if you look at the ownership issue, we had ARCE and the depositor were the only two who had any ownership. There were no rights to any performer. Now, I don't think that was deliberate in any case, but it was just so happens, if you look at it, if you say this can be only listened to, it doesn't make an exception for a performer or for the community. And that seemed like a major flaw there. But it's something that we discovered as we went on. It's not something you realize because it just that's how it was in those days. So I'm kind of looking at this in three phases. The second was, I think, maybe 10 years down the line when we entered our first fieldwork project, which we always call the Rajasthan Atlas Project. It is, this was again a partnership with Rupayan Sansthan in Rajasthan. Daniel Newman was the person leading it from the ARC end as the head of the advisory, and I was there as the ARC person. So this was our first field project, and we called it the Ethnographic Atlas of Music Traditions in Western Rajasthan. It finally got published as a book called Bards, Ballads, and Boundaries. So this was important for various reasons that I just mentioned that, you know, brought in. So as you can see, it's increasing our community. We also got involved with the Smithsonian Global Sound Project, which meant that we agreed to put up about 500 tracks, of which we've done 200, for Global Sound, which again meant entering into a different kind of agreement. And initially, it really scared me to approach depositors and say, you know, can we now use this commercially? Because this was not the idea. But we did do that. We contacted all our collectors and depositors and took their help in many cases to contact performers. So that's what we did there. So that kind of changed how we work and set up a different kind of relationship. And I think I will give that detail a little later. We were surprisingly ahead of the kind of number of tracks that we thought we would be able to get. So a lot of people who had otherwise, this is interesting, had chosen the listening only option, were very quick to give us permission, because I think the performers were to get. So the structure of the Smithsonian was the Smithsonian gets 50%, the participating archive gets 25%, and the performer gets 25%. So that's much higher than any kind of royalty that they would have got for any other commercial use. It's for paid downloads. Maybe some of you have seen it. We also, in that same period, did a festival. This was something, again, a different kind of thing from our normal kind of work called Remembered Rhythms, which was to do with diaspora and the music of India. I can't always call it Indian music, where we brought three groups, not brought in all cases, the Siddhi Goma, which is a group of Indian African community that's come to India many centuries ago. And that's the African diaspora in India. We had a Chutney group from Trinidad, which is the Indian diaspora in the Caribbean. And the third was a group of Indian Jews based in London called the Rivers of Babylon. So this was again a kind of extension, looking at other communities, taking that opportunity to archive the music. But we toured them in 7 cities of India, each with an ethnomusicologist. We had a seminar before that to debate how diaspora and music intersect, and we produced some publications, books, and a CD. So in this phase, you can see that the community is extending to act more actively with performers, with musician communities who were involved in actually collecting data for the Atlas project, with online users, with the Smithsonian Global Sound Project, and partner institutions. And this has been a trend, and we've gone on to work with many, many institutions after that. So looking at where we are with the IPR then, so we altered our options, so it could not include performers, and all depositors were really quite happy to do that. I think they hadn't really thought about it. And we had in this phase started taking an active role in creating permission forms for field workers or giving them documents to say that this recordings are in the archive for them to use. And I think a lot of, especially foreign scholars, welcomed that because they sometimes felt people would feel happier knowing that the recordings are in India for them and their and people to use. We also then had to start creating agreements for sharing collections, first with Rupa and Sanstan, with whom we were working in Rajasthan, but in this way with other institutions, and creating permissions for recording, for field work, how we would use that, what would be the rights of the performer versus us, and so on. And then, as I mentioned, for Global Sound, we had to create other forms of permission. So our relationship with our community, with the people who were using, as well as with who were depositing, had changed quite a bit by then. At that point, interestingly, the Copyright Act in India also changed in 1992 and brought in 2 major amendments. One was the performer right, which gives the performer a right over their own performance. It's not to do with the material, so that all still remains traditional cultural expression, but you have control over your own performance, which meant then the recording. So the recording then could not be used in any way which is not agreed to, and any use that was not agreed to would be considered a violation of the performer right. So this is a major implication, and then we had to look at that along with our depositor agreement and fair dealing, which we did not have very clearly stated earlier. And fair dealing is different from fair use in the US and so on. This fair dealing only allows very specific kinds of use. So even with educational use, it's down to classroom use and so on. So it's very fixed there. Going on to sort of the last phase, the one I wanted to talk about, and which led to our project called Archives and Community Partnership. It came out of a lot of concerns that were in the back there because of realizing from working for many years from 1982, you could see in various ways that documentation and research are also is an intervention, the way we go about it. Researchers like to think that they are very a positive force, that this is something very objective. In many cases in India, that was, we're only documenting, we're not doing anything else. But you can see that it's an intervention. It changes how people look at their own heritage, changes how it's used. And we could see very big changes in the patronage and transmission of a lot of traditional music. As the patronage changes, what people think they want to perform changes, how it gets transmitted changes a lot. A major concern that we heard from a lot of musicians was the shrinking traditional repertoire, that as things got out of the context and were performed more and more for the stage, you could get away with knowing 20 songs rather than 200, which is what you knew traditionally. Inadequate rights management, I think we've gone on about that enough, and more traditions being performed outside of context, which was changing them in lots of ways, and we were hearing this from musicians in our work, that you know they were concerned about what will the next generation know, and this is all going to be dead, and every time a major senior musician dies, we lose so much repertoire and so on. also looking at the state, kind of in India, there's a big trend of creating competitions for every kind of form that they feel is kind of threatened. So you have state level competitions where 200 groups come to perform some traditional form, which really has no stage presence half the time, but it's just to be able to give some prizes and do this. And so you, everything that is a ritual or a traditional performance is getting changed to something that you get your 5 minute slot on the stage for. So we felt that was again a very negative thing. And this whole idea of looking at culture as a monolith, I think we're also, I was personally reacting to right-wing party in India at that time, which seemed to be gaining ground, wanting to look at India as one kind of whole. And we had all these things that were happening along the side with UNESCO coming out with more community-based, with discussion on the subaltern and more focus on the local. So what the opportunities we had for doing this project was that there was a concern expressed by the communities. It wasn't something that for once, it was not just our agenda. And this came out of more interaction because of our own field projects, because of trying to reach more performers for Global Sound. We found that more people were coming to the archives asking for recordings. They wanted to use them for teaching, or they would come and say, do you have my father's recording? Do you have my wedding? You know, these kinds of things. And that was happening more and more. And that was kind of encouraging us to think. And I think the big change there was digital technology. The fact that we could make good recordings out in the field, that there was no concept of an original and a copy anymore. It was easy to distribute copies and easy to think of creating products that could be used. And definitely greater access to technology in rural areas in India. The cassette was the first, and then the CD was quite common. And as I discovered, most of all, the mobile phone. So we went into this project for 3 years, which ended in 2011, I think. And it was supported by the Ford Foundation. We called it Archives and Community Partnership. And the whole idea was to create a bunch of partnerships with the community leadership, try and create advisory committees, train local documentation teams. So the whole idea was that you use the community to members to do the recordings, to increase the sense of ownership with over the whole project. I think that worked. And the idea was that we would archive the materials at ARCE for kind of international scholarly access, make sure there was a copy at the state level. And if we found any movement, we would support a local archive. And we also wanted to take this opportunity to put everything in one basket to see if we could create some economic models to share revenue and share rights with, because we also thought the archive also needs to make some money, even though it's never going to be real money, but I think we needed to establish a relationship where we could share this. So the idea also was of attempting a more global as well as a local kind of dissemination. And these were some of the ideas we had. I'm going to skip going into any detail here, because this was just the plans, and that we would like to also do a website. That was part of the plan, and you can see where we got with it. Coming to the rights, I thought this was a very good time for us to really enter the rights issues in more detail and see what we could do, because one of the things that I noticed with how much ever bottom-up documentation we were talking about, that our administration of rights remained very, very top-down. We always thought we knew what was best. You know, you should sign this, you should get money for this, you should make sure your permission is taken and so on. And I thought I hadn't seen, in spite of doing some consulting with WIPO around that time, I hadn't seen any empirical study of rights perceptions. You know, what do people really think, where does the ownership lie? Who do they think are the owners? And this, we came up with some interesting things there. And wanted to include non-financial parameters. I think that was one of the other major discoveries, that when you look at issues, I found about 80% were not to do with money. They were to do with being acknowledged, or lack of attribution, or not the right kind of respect, or using it in other contexts. So we thought that would be a good place to do this. And maybe create a scale of payments based on the kinds of use, because archives very often get stuck with, you know, we take permission for one kind of thing and we haven't thought of what else might come along the way, and then you find you can't really use it. And we wanted to see how we could share rights, formulate oral agreements as well as written agreements, though we were told later that by lawyers that oral agreements don't hold, but it still helps to work towards people understanding what they're signing, and assure long-term performer and community access. This came up again and again in talking to musicians, urban as well as rural, that they feel very often they're denied access to their own recordings once they are in an archive, that a lot of people were viewing the archival process with some suspicion and sometimes with some anger because of this. And we thought we would like to do whatever we could to support community ownership here. So the communities we were looking at, this was a so-called pilot project. We worked in two areas in India, Rajasthan and Goa. And we had chose three communities in Rajasthan. All of these are hereditary professional musician communities. So they perform music as a way of life. If you're born in a community, you have to be a musician. If you're not a very good musician, you just go along with the other musicians and you get your share. So these were the three we were looking at. They're all, as I said, musician castes. And this project, we had this underlying idea that I think was carried on from our Remembered Rhythms days of pluralistic traditions and marginalized groups. Though these musicians are now world famous and tour the world, they still have a very low social status in their own communities. They are very marginalized groups. They are largely very poor, except for the few hundred who tour. So what we did with these three communities was met with some elders, as you can see, and some younger musicians, and we sat down with them and worked out what the plan for recording would be over 3 years, and what they would like to do, how they would like to record, what they would like to record, and how they would like to use these recordings. In Goa, I was particularly interested in the fact of this long colonization. They've had 450 years of Portuguese rule, as opposed to 200 of British for the rest of India, which was very late. Goa became part of India in 1961. So it's in a lot of people's living memory. Also, unlike India, they had the whole issue of forced conversion. So you had many people who had been Catholics for 200 years, 300 years. So that obviously had changed how you were looking at things. And this was, so the post-colonial is a bigger factor in Goa. We're looking at syncretic traditions and again marginalized groups. So I chose two things here. One was the Gowda community, which are considered in all literature as the indigenous owners of Goa. They are supposed to be the oldest tribe in Goa. And many of them got converted. And both the Christian Gowdas, there was a large part that didn't get converted, who are now called the Hindu Gowdas. They probably were not Hindu, they're just their own tribal religion. And there's a third part that were reconverted in 1928. So I thought that this kind of group would give me a little laboratory-like place to look at what the impact was of colonization and conversion on the music. And for the other, the genre called the mando, which is a kind of symbol of the very marginalized elite of Goa. So I was very happy Ford Foundation bought that idea that, you know, the elite could also be marginalized and be an interesting group to study, because this was the group that was in power for 450 years and now very marginalized in independent India. And they have a very interesting genre called the mando, which I don't think has any parallelism in India. The text is Konkani, which is the language of Goa, written by Goan poets and Goan composers. So it's Western music, but it's composed by Goan composers, and also had a social dance attached to it, which is still there, which was very influenced by the minuet and things of its time, of those times, and still danced at weddings. And the concern among this group was looking at the contemporary mando and the changes that were coming in, and this desire to see this original glory of the mando preserved. So listening to the community, these were the two things that we decided to do there. So that's a family, Goan family, the Kottas, who sing the Mando within the family. This was, we were told, the kind of iconic kind of Mando that is sung, and we produced some CDs. And as you can see, we were giving copies of all recordings to the people in the community or the performers. So that's a family looking at their own videos and so on. So finally, what came of this is that you heard about all our aims, but we did manage to do this, not everything that we planned to do, but we made recordings with the community consultation. In Goa, we did village case studies, looking at the place of music in the village. And like Rajasthan, we were looking at what the community does. And in all cases, we did provide copies to the performer or the community with giving them full rights. We managed to do the capacity building. We had local documentation trained in both places. We held workshops, and in Goa as well as in Rajasthan, I always just went alone and all the recording was done by the people there. And we created some institutional partnerships. Through those, with Rupayan Sansthan in Goa, we also did children's workshops where about 100 children were taught by 10 senior musicians. We did two such children's camps. And in Goa, the kind of work that we were doing with the Gowda community and the assistants who were working really influenced some of the students' projects. Students who were from these marginalized communities who started wanting to work on their own communities and look at them more critically. So that was an interesting outcome. These are just the workshop photographs. Yes, I'm nearly done. Been racing through. So on the left is the girl who was from the Gowda community, who became an assistant on the project. And when I reflect on this project, I say nothing else happened. This girl, Mozina Fernandez, happened because she went on to work on the music of her community and is now registered for a PhD and is just got a job at the Department of Sociology. So that's something that happened from somebody who was moving on from questioning, you know, when she first started working on this project, she very naively wrote a paper called Where Are All the Songs Gone? Because she started looking around her village and she says, nobody sings, madam. So I said, what do you mean nobody sings? So she just, you know, hadn't figured out what was going on. She had cousins who were saying, oh, you want to call yourself a Gowda, you're welcome, I'm not. Because so this was a community rejecting its very marginalized status. We have something called the scheduled castes and tribes in India, which becomes a kind of a stigma. So surprisingly, we had all these nice young women learning to record and work. And the other one is in Rajasthan. And that young man in the brown shirt went on to be number 4 on Indian Idol. So sometimes some kind of results we didn't quite look for. So in talking about all our dissemination, what we managed, one was this website, which held us up for another 15 minutes. So I'll come to that last because I didn't have any samples to show you. We did manage to do a series of CDs called Master Musicians from the Archives. And this was again a case of listening to the community because we wanted to do CDs. The whole idea of this project was, okay, let's create at least a small body of music which will be with the right kind of ownership, with the right kind of permissions. This is what we would like. We can't change the other 200 collections, but at least we can do this right. And then we can produce CDs, we'll do broadcasting, we will put it on the internet, and we'll do all these nice things. But what I was hearing all the time while working was, can we have recordings of Bhungar Khan? Can we have this? Can you know, you have this in the archive, could we have that? And the story in Goa with the Mando was the same, you know, to restore the Mando to its glory, for people to be able to hear what this music really should be, the way it's sung in families. There's also talk about failures. The music of the Gowdas or the villages we did not manage really to do CDs or do anything of that kind, because this makes you aware of what happens with community rights. Individuals were very unwilling to sign on behalf of a whole community. They were so every time I went back, can we discuss this next week? Or when you come next? So I decided we could abandon that. So for show and tell, we have a set of CDs here, which I'd be happy to, I brought for Paradisic. I don't know where where you hold them, but still, there they are. And on the CDs, we worked with the musicians. They selected the tracks that are there. We made detailed notes with their help, with the lyrics in the local languages, so the young people could learn from these little pamphlets and sing. And what I'm happiest about is that 35% of the CDs have gone back to the community. So it's kind of a grassroots distribution as well as more rights. So they got money for the 400, which is quite a lot, and 250 CDs to sell as they wish. The broadcasting, we kind of failed with All India Radio or looking at other things. So we finally did 5 programs on community radio for a community radio that works out of Gurgaon, where we are situated, who look at migrant workers as one of their audiences. And there's a lot of migrant workers from Rajasthan where we are situated. So we thought that might be a good thing to do. There was a young musician who Kevin has met who had started something called the Manganiyar Lok Sangeet Sanstan, which means the Manganiyar Folk Music Institute. And he had been keen and had made some moves to doing his little archive. So we supported that with some equipment and training. And he is now a depositor with the archives. The one thing that we discovered through this project was the mobile was where it's at. So everywhere, it's the mobile that's being used. In fact, I did a YASA paper called the Digital Dissolve, because they're using it for recording, for audio, video, photographs. They share the material. It just goes from phone to phone. So I kind of like to think of it as a cloud. And so we thought, have to do something. So we created an application on the Android platform. So anybody who uses Android can have that for free. These were the kind of research objectives we had to come to your looking at the research, no records, but some responsibilities. So I think these are the kind of issues that we looked at. I'm not going to read through them since I know I'm running out. I think it changed the way we work with people, it's changed the way communities work with us, and it's set the stage for the way we work with a lot of other institutions. What we did, we kind of found out all the problems with community-led initiatives that I've talked about. We realized that research still it is an intervention no matter what we do. We learned about consensus and roles and perceptions of rights and ownerships. And I kind of got less romantic about how syncretic Goa is, or Rajasthan musicians are, who are Muslims and sing for Hindu patrons. Did you realize it's all a matter of negotiation one way or the other? And that conversion and traditional roles had a lot of interaction, and we learned about the mobile. So what we did here was looking at how we've changed. So obviously we have agreements with performers that we think now have to be created for each project. What we did in Rajasthan largely was to draft them out, have them translated into their own language, have a member of the group who can read it out to the rest so that they're all happy with the way it is, and they sign it only after that. And we, in all cases, gave all the performers or the community complete rights over the copies of the recordings that they received. They're free to do what they like with it. And if we use it in any way, we will make sure that a minimum of 25% of the net price goes to them. And if they want, they can sign up for that right then, or they can do it later. We could go back to them. So this is where we were, which brings me to the end. I'm going to show you the website. You know, because we've been all talking about working with communities, with giving access to the materials that's in the archives, to giving copies. And I've been really thinking about how much do we do it because it makes us feel good? And what is the benefit for the community? Most people want it. It's in many cases a matter of ownership. It's a matter of control. Oh, we have our recordings. But do we really think of it, do we change our documentation and our cataloging to suit a community? Because we carry on in our own archival ways and we say, okay, here's your copy. But do our categories, the way we document, does it make sense for them to use it the way they want to use it? Most of the time, I think it's for creating a community memory. They want to use it for teaching. They want it as a mark of their identity, their ownership, and they want to control it. And I think this is what I think we have to look at and try and integrate into our archival systems if we say that we want to create community archives. So that's it. I wanted to show you our,
okay,
that's my shoulder, to show you the website. Now you can show me how to do that. So you can sign on this website. You can, if you sign on, you can edit the content. But it's got this radio that goes on with the thing. If you want more information, you can click on more. So we've got a mix of commercial as well as field recordings here. So that's how the radio works. And if you don't like the particular track, you can skip. So you can get the information, that's the radio. And there's only a little bit of linking. We've got, you can click on the genre and you get the notes there, and you can find out we've got 8 photographs of this group, 3 more audio. So it breaks into the radio. So this is what happens here. We've got look up for genres from where you're seeing this, as well as instruments. So you can look for any instrument and so you can search for that. And the main thing was a directory of musicians. If you look at anybody in detail, you get their information. The whole idea is that they can, you can find them without their, as you can see, this also goes on. And books, articles. So if you look for, you can search for the Mango. It's quick. It brings you up all the books. We're doing a feature. And you can contribute. We took that off. That's the project. And I think what I like most is our credits page. Okay. So that's what that is. Thank you. Okay. I want to. Okay, just can just turn it off.
We just, yeah. Oh, I was just going to say we could leave.
Yes.
Just make it silent.
I think the sound's gone.
Yeah.
Happily. Okay.
Well, thank you. Let's join. I wrote a paper back in 2004 called Turning It All Upside Down, which was all about the revolution in relationships between archives and the communities that they reflect and serve, and how that was being totally transformed by digital technologies and the availability of these connections and collaborations. And so I think this paper is just a wonderful showing of how that's been how Schubert's group has been able to just do some fantastic work that I think is a wonderful inspiration. We've got about 4 or 5 minutes for questions. So anybody with a question for Schubert?
What's your funding after the Ford Foundation?
Ford has been always a project funding for us. They funded our Remembered Rhythms, they funded this project. So it's always been project funding, and we've been able to do some of our best project work with Ford money because they were always very easy to work with,
mm-hmm.
but they pulled out of art and culture entirely. So it's a big, big problem for us. So I think it's going to be a different way that
We've just signing on with a project in a neighboring area of Rajasthan called Kutch, with a musicians collective there called Surwani, who got a grant from a development agency to document and archive. So they'll be bringing in the funding for that. So I think it will be a different way now for each project. But I think this helped us to also formalize. We have worked with other regional archives before, and we had more money, digitized a lot of collections, and so on, and worked in training. We've done other kind of work, but I think this project helped us to also gain our stripes in being able to do this kind of work with other organizations. I think it'll be one thing at a time now.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the uptake of the app that you've made. So whether you feel like it's being used a lot, or what your impression is.
Well, I have very little money to make it, so I haven't been able to really find out how much it's being used. I was kind of hoping for it to go viral, at least among the musicians who share. But since it's Android, and we had to do Android because it was the cheapest thing we could do, you don't have to pay for the OS. So it's a small app that has 6 tracks on it. Also, how to do it fairly. So what I did is was to do it to support the CD series. So there's 6 tracks which appear on the CDs. So it's, you know, it's like the CD, the musicians have got the money for the CDs, they continue to sell them, and it's kind of promoting the CD. But it doesn't have the information how you can buy the CD, it doesn't have any, we didn't manage to put in information on how to get back to ARC if you liked it and so on. So I really don't have a way to track that. Also, not all the musicians have Android phones, so that's a bit of a problem there. But I think they're kind of happy.
I'm just wondering about the agreements with the performers. If they just last for their lifetime, or if they pass on to anyone else in the community, their family?
2 things. In Rajasthan, we talked to the people what they thought was fair, because a lot of the thing belongs to the whole community. But I said, how would you like the whole community to benefit? Do you think you, how do you want to do it? And they finally all thought it was okay for it to be just related to the performer. But I think that we would not, I mean, we haven't written, you know, who's going to inherit the rights or anything like that. So it is, the benefits would go, and I don't see the benefits going to another generation. But what we did do is to make sure that anybody of that community can access the material in the archives. That's a permanent ongoing thing, because a lot of them had concerns. They said, once you're gone, maybe nobody let us come into the archive. So we had to make sure of that. In Goa, where we were working with the village as an entity, looking at, you know, what place music has in that community, and there were villages that were confined to a community each. So there, that's not an individual right, and it's just anybody from that village. That's the kind of agreement we came out with there. So we figured it had to be different.
Yeah. Last question.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your comments. I really appreciate, amongst many of them, your comments about research as intervention. And I'm wondering whether there are any positive changes in terms of revaluing. You talk about the young woman who's nobody singing anymore, and she documented and she's going on and doing her PhD. Is there anything that you see actually in terms of revaluing at the community level, where people are beginning to sing the songs again?
No, I definitely, yeah, I think it's an intervention, though very often a positive one. I think the negative thing was that we have been seeing is that somebody comes and records something, and then people would say that's the thing, but that's got recorded by such and such scholar and they published it. So there's that danger of that being looked as the correct version because that got into the book or that came on the radio. So, you know, that kind of thing. But I think that we did see a lot of positive things. When I went back to Goa a year after I was at the ritual theater performance that I had recorded for 3 years. And one of the villages, they said, oh, we knew you were coming. A lot more of the young people would have taken part. And it was not that they didn't see, they weren't, I didn't have time to talk about all of this in detail, but sometimes people didn't want copies anymore. The first time they were excited about having a copy. Then it was okay.
But they still just enjoyed the process, the fact that somebody was there and that they were learning to record and other people were recording, and you know, they just enjoyed the whole activity as part of the event. So I think it gave them a sense of their own value. So I think that is a positive thing.
Well, thank you very much, Shuga. I'm sure that we'll all have more questions. Oh, thank you very much. We'll have to fight over these between the Melbourne,
yes,
and Canberra and Sydney ends of things. I'll just get track of them now. Our next speaker is Andrea Emily. Andrea is an assistant professor at York University in Canada, previously at the University of Western Australia, and where she still has an honorary affiliation. And Andrea is going to be talking